This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Australian winemaker Jeff Merrill. How are you, Jeff?
Good, Chris. How are you? Well, it's nice and sunny here. I presume it's not so there.
Looking at the sky, it's pretty early over here. The sun's not quite up, so I couldn't tell you. I think we've got a nice fluffy blanket of clouds, which keeps it nice and warm, keeps the heat in, so we're not using too much Russian gas. You're based in McLaren Vale in South Australia, just sort of south of Adelaide.
Yes, that's right. Well, actually, it's in a sub-district. The winery's in a sub-district called Ranelagh. This state was founded in 1836, and Chateau Ranelagh was built in 1838. And we're about 3 kilometres away from Chateau Ranelagh. It's an old property called Mount Hertel, and that was built in 1897. Vineyards were planted in 1890. So, you know, Australia doesn't have much European history, and we certainly don't have old wine history, but we do have old viticultural history because of Europe being wiped out at times by phylloxera.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I was actually, last week I did a podcast on some of the old vines that are in McLaren Vale, and some of them are getting pretty old, but when I went through that list that the McLaren Vale Tourist Board put out, you had some wines there, but they weren't really, really super old. I presume that's your Mount Hertel site, is it?
Yeah, no, that's Mount Hertel site. We buy fruit in from growers that have got 100-year-old vines because I haven't got those. I don't own those vineyards. But, yeah, we've got two lots of wines, a Grenache and a Shiraz, that come off the Shiraz is off well over 100-year-old vines.
Yeah.
Well, and the Grenaches as well.
Okay. What I want to do, Jeff, is I want to spend a bit of time just because you've had quite a varied and reasonably long run at the wine industry. Yeah, you've been in it for like 42 years now.
I started in 1970, so I've had 52 years.
Jeepers, you don't look over 50, mate, so you're doing well.
Feel it.
Yeah, so 1970, you're right, when you joined, was it Seppel and Sam?
Yes, Seppel's were in the Barossa Valley in Tanunda. Well, they were at Seppelsfield, but that's where I worked with.
Were you a winemaker back then, or...?
Yeah, I got accepted to Roseworthy Enology School in 1969, or the end of 1969, and Seppelts had a scheme where they trained their own winemakers, did a four-year course apprenticeship, basically, and also in conjunction with the Institute of Technology in Adelaide. And so I got accepted to Roseworthy, but Seppelts paid $54 a week end of 1969, so that was a better deal, I thought. So that's what I did, and I've never regretted that because we did all the sciences. We had to work in the central laboratory for 3 years before we got posted out into production laboratories and also then winemaking. And we learned everything from vinegar making to champagne making to sherry making to quality control of glass and cork. And, you know, it was everything that we learned was specific. The chemistry and everything we learned was specific to the wine industry. So it was pretty good. I was the last one through with another friend of mine who is now a Lutheran minister, David Gogol. So Golly and I were the last two through. And after us, they realised that the cost of training us, it was easier to employ Roseworthy graduates. So that's what they did after us. But, you know, we had an intensive training. It was fantastic.
It's interesting you started in the lab because a lot of people, when they think of the Australian wine industry anyway, well, I do anyway, I always think of it as being technically very, very good. The Frenchies and that will do all sorts of weird and wonderful things that a technical Australian winemaker might think is a little bit inappropriate, but the Australians always try and make very well made technical wines, with hardly any faults, really.
Well, I think the difference is that a lot of French winemakers, their grandfather was the cellar master, then their father was the cellar master, and then they became the cellar master. So you could pass it down to a complete idiot. And in some cases, I think that's happened. So at least here, other than family-owned companies, that could easily happen in as well. Most of the winemakers have at least some decent qualifications, so that if something does go wrong, like we do occasionally get bad vintages here, they at least know how to correct it or to at least work with it.
Yeah.
Not always the case in old Europe. But Germany's a totally different exception. The people are very highly trained in most wineries in Germany.
I would have thought these days, you know, you don't see a lot of people into the trade who haven't had some sort of formal training. There's a lot of...
No, that's true. Whether it be Bordeaux or Burgundy training or whether it was, you know, the great colleges now are still Geisenheim, still Rosewater here or Adelaide University, Stellenbosch in South Africa, Davis in the States. You know, there's some pretty good training grounds around the world.
Yeah. When you were at Seppel, did you guys, is it Seppel or Seppelt?
Seppel.
Seppel.
S-E-P-P-E-L-T, Seppel.
Yeah.
They were one of the oldest wine companies in Australia, but they got taken over. Well, they're part of the Treasury Group now.
Because 1970s was right at the time when Australia changed over from sort of fortified wines as its sort of main wine to still wines. So were you in that transition period?
Well, yeah, that was the early part of the table wine revolution, I suppose, in Australia. You know what? If you went to a wedding in the early, even into the 70s, you were offered a glass of beer or a sweet sherry or a dry sherry. You know, that there was no such thing as a glass of Riesling on the tray or anything like that. That period of time, like when I first started in the wine industry, there was less than 80 wineries in Australia. So, you know, and a lot of them did make table wines and some fantastic stuff. You know, Seppelt's made some amazing wines out of their properties in Great Western and red wines back into the 40s and things like that that are today, if you could get hold of a bottle of an O'Shea wine made out of 47, you'd go off your head. And it's just sensational wines. There was certainly a misconception by the old world and probably in particular the UK that thought that Australian wines never aged. But that was to the contrary. You know, if you look at the stats that I looked at it from Chateaurinella, in 1914, Chateaurinella crushed nearly 5,000 tonne of fruit. And a big lot of that was sold in bulk to Europe, particularly France. And so it's interesting. And then they made wines that have got incredible ageing potential and still age today.
What were the French doing with the wines?
Back blending it, obviously, to give guts to a bit of wine that came from other parts of... I don't know what part of France it went to, but I just know from the export details that I could see. But they've done that for years. They take Bulgarian wine and blend it in. And I don't know if they still do that. They have done that over the years.
Yeah, I know of North African wines were used to be added to Burgundy and things like that, but I don't think that's allowed anymore.
Not allowed, but I'm sure it happened.
Yeah.
Allegedly. Isn't it allegedly the word you use when you don't want to get sued?
Yeah, exactly, allegedly. Well, I don't think we're blaming anybody there. So you were at Seppel, you moved to Chateaurinella, as you said.
Well, I worked overseas. I went overseas in 1974 and worked for Stellenbosch Farmers Winery, 74 and 75 vintage. I was their experimental winemaker. And one of the great wine people of the world was there, a guy called Francis Bailey, F.C. Bailey, a wonderful man, who died only last year from a heart attack, sadly. But Davey was a visionary in lots of respects, you know, like how he treated the local people, and it was fantastic. So, yeah, I learned a lot there because that period of time, 1974 and 75, I think, South Africa certainly led the world in terms of technology. They had a lot of German winemakers working there. They had all sorts of people working there, but they were quite innovative in what they were doing. The Americans saw what they were doing and they were able to implement it because they had more money. But South Africa certainly in those years was very innovative. And when I left there in 75 and came home, I applied for a job at Chatarinella, which was owned by Rothmans, which was a South African company effectively. And I just told them what we were doing in South Africa and they were pretty impressed and employed me straight away. And that gave me the start that I needed it back in Australia, which was really good.
And then Hardy's purchased Chatarinella, what, in the 1980s, wasn't it?
1982, Hardy's bought Rinella, but I'd already been given permission by the Rothmans board to start my own label. So I started making my own wines in 1980 with a Cabernet, mm-hmm. and 1981 with a Semillon. And then in 1982, I made a Cabernet again and another Semillon. And when Hardy's took over for vintage 1983, I don't think they were too enamoured about me making my own wines, but they wanted me to work for them. So I said, well, you can't have both. So you either have me and let me make some of my own wines or you have none of us. So they let me make supposedly 500 dozen of each in the 1983 vintage, which was probably in a way a bit of a blessing because I used a lot of Coonawarra fruit in 1983 and a lot of damage to the wines because of the botrytis rot that was in there in Coonawarra and Pathway. And even when we sort of heat treated it, but it was all. So the wines won, the 1983 Cabernets won a lot of gold medals, but because of the lacquers in there, they went brown and went off. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, sadly. Yeah, so I worked with them until 1985 as an employee, and then 1985 I went out on my own and they employed me as a consultant, and my job was to improve the quality of their red wines, and that culminated in 1988 with winning the Jimmy Watson for them. And then I came back and because we got Mount Hurdle up and running in about 1987. So I just couldn't spend the time that I was spending for them with my own stuff.
Mount Hurdle was a joint venture with you and a couple of other guys.
Yeah, just one other bloke. I've got a local chemist called Trevor Stratton and myself.
A chemist? That's a strange combination.
Yeah, pharmacist, not a... Oh, well, he was a wine lover and had a bit of spare cash, so we put it together and built, well, Mount Hurdle on a shoestring, really. Anyway, it's still there.
Yeah, yeah. Is that still your basis of your own vineyards?
No, it's only on 7 acres, so it's really just caught up in suburbia now. But, the basis of our vineyards are Coonawarra, where I've got my own vineyards, and lease vineyards at Mount Bold. And we sold a big vineyard two years ago, but we still get the fruit from that vineyard, a lot of the fruit. We just had too many varieties on there that we didn't want.
Okay, fair enough. Now, well, you did some work for Sainsbury's. You're saying that you did some work for Sainsbury's in Australia.
1993. I was in Sainsbury's trying to sell them some product and I can't remember who the buyer was then because they rotated their buyers so they didn't get too friendly. But this bloke wanted me to do a job for him and in the end he finished up buying about 20,000 cases of my wine, which was, I mean, I was on cloud nine and I was willing to do just about anything that they asked me. So they asked me whether I'd make wine in Bulgaria and I said, well, I'm not really interested in making wine in Bulgaria. And they said, what about Italy? And I said, well, I'd love to make wine in Italy. You know, my family background on my father's side is Italian. So I said, okay. So I said, I've got to have a look at it first. So I came back in July 1993 and we spent a week driving from the south of Italy, from Frascati right the way to the north up to Mezzocorona and looked at all the properties in between where I might be making wine. And I tasted the wines and said, yeah, I could definitely make a difference here. The project was about a $35 million US project annually. It was a big project, about 1 million cases of wine. So I got started. I got to Italy in end of August 1993, and it had piss strain, one of the biggest, worst vintages that you'd ever like to think about. And, you know, like we were dealing with stuff, you know, I've never seen the likes of it. You know, if it rains in Australia, you just wait a couple of days and you can get back onto a vineyard, as long as you don't have a lot of split. And but over there, it rained and it rained and rained. You just couldn't get on. And with a lot of that pergola system that they had there, it was, you know, there was a lot of rot around. Anyway, we finished up making some pretty good wines out of 93 vintage. And then it just went on from there. I finished, my last vintage for them was 2000, I think, 93, 94, 95, 6 or 7, 8. No, 99 it must have been. And then Joe DeFabio, who worked for me, he went and did the 2000 vintage for him. But we've always had a good relationship. I think the boss of Gruppo Italiano Vini at the time was a man called Emilio Padron, and I think Emilio Padron is one of the most underrated men in the world wine industry. I think that he was a total visionary. He was the one that thought that wines could be made better. He had a vision of having classic varieties in, you know, the Alto Adige and all of that. And, you know, he went on to be, I think he's a director of Botani and places like that now, but he was a man that employed me, and he was a man that said to me, you make the calls, you tell them what you want out of the vineyards, and he said, and I will back you. And I remember, it's not hard for me to upset people at the best of times, but I upset quite a lot of growers because I said, a good winemaker makes great wines out of great grapes. A good winemaker can make reasonable wines out of ordinary grapes. Doesn't matter how good the winemaker is, if you give him shit grapes, he can't do anything. So I said, a lot of the problems with what you've got here is that you're overcropping, you're not letting sunlight through. Oh, listen, I gave it to him. Well, I thought I was going to get murdered by the winemakers of Bartolino, but anyway, I survived. And Padron was fantastic. And we made, 94 was a great vintage, 95 was even better. You know, 95, the wines were fantastic. So I'm pretty pleased about what we did in Italy. It was great, and I loved it. You know, I finished up giving all my instructions in Italian, and not that I can talk it at all now. I can probably swear at a few people, and that's about all, but it was wonderful.
Did you find that they, because you said earlier that when you first arrived, they were using pergola systems, which has the, you know, just basically the fruit hanging below, really, usually. Trellising is a much more common type of system now. Have you found the Italians were they changing over to trellising systems at the time?
Yeah, in a lot of places, trellising was already being used, you know, and that's no problem. It was just in some of the older areas that it wasn't. No, they were well in tune with what they needed to do. And you know, the one thing I've found with most of the Italian, young Italian winemakers, they were keen to learn, you know, and I wasn't exactly old at the time, but I had my 40th birthday there, 93. But they were really keen to learn. I enjoyed their company. One thing I did learn, every village was different. Every village has its own cuisine, often its own dialect, and also it has wines that are very local to those areas. So, you know, I collect wines from Antinori. I love Tignanello and things like that, but they're the big picture wines. But the small picture wines is a small grower down the road that produces a little bit of wine and sells it to a few local restaurants and sells it to his mates. And those wines were really, you would never be able to buy them anywhere in the world other than in that little village. You look at Australian wines around that time, a lot of wine was being produced to win medals in shows, probably playing lip service to food and wine. Whereas in Italy, a lot of the wines wouldn't have won a gold medal if it fit in a wine show where it was side by side, but put it with the food from the town that they were produced from, and everything started to work. The one thing I learned about that whole thing was about food and wine combinations and how important food is with wine and wine is with food. they worked together. And I remember going to the Hotel de Vana in Winchester, and Gerard Basset was a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine. And I got there one day and he was really busy. And he said, "Oh, sorry, Jeff." He said, "I will come and talk to you afterwards." But so he said, "The best thing is there was a tomato, fresh tomato and basil with bocconcini that he had." And he said, "This is magnificent. You must eat this." And he went and he said, "And this is the wine to go with it." And at that stage, at the time, German whites weren't that popular at the time, but he had a Auslese that he gave me a glass of. And I've always loved old German whites and the Swedish styles as well. And the combination of food and wine was just extraordinary, you know. And Gerard knew what he was doing. And so that was fantastic. So food and wine combinations are ultra important to me. And I think it's bullshit when people say, "Oh, such and such a wine goes with fish," or "such and such a wine goes with chicken." Well, what rubbish. I mean, how did you cook the chicken? How did you cook the fish? So-and-so goes with white meats, and then you put a Cajun sauce with it. You know, like, you can't say that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you can mix and match whatever. I drink red wine with white and white with red meats. It doesn't worry me.
No.
It just depends on what.
I agree with you. I think there's you can pigeonhole things too much. There's some basic structural stuff that's important, but apart from that, you can have a bit of fun. Okay, Jeff, I think what we'll do is that's sort of got us up to the point where almost to modern day times. And what I want to do next week is just talk about some of the wines you're producing at the moment. And in particular, one of the things that seems to be your point of difference, which I love, is the fact that you release the wines after a little bit of aging. So next week I want to talk a wee bit about aging and a little bit about your range of wines and sort of just understand what's going on there and if there's any different winemaking practices that you follow for wines that you release a little bit earlier versus a little bit older. Okay?
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Cool.